All right, we're ready to get started. Hello and welcome to another edition of Under the Weather, Climate Change Research and Justice. Under the Weather is a monthly lecture series brought to you by CKUT 90.3 FM, McGill Sustainability Projects Fund, and Climate Justice Montreal. We are here at McGill University and are broadcasting this talk live on CKUT's airwaves at 90.3 FM and online at ckut.ca. To hear past lectures, you can now subscribe to our podcast on iTunes simply by searching CKUT Under the Weather. And this edition will soon be uploaded as well. It just needs to happen first. To find out more about the project and upcoming events, you can visit undertheweather.ckut.ca. And before we get started with our speaker tonight, I want to invite up to the mic Thomas Pringle and Tyler Lawson from the Moving Image Research Lab at McGill. They are organizing a new project through the Sustainability Projects Fund that they are going to tell you more about. And I'm also really excited to announce that we will be collaborating with them in June on a new project. So stay tuned for that. Tyler?
Hello, everyone, fellow travelers. My name's Tyler. I'm collaborating with Thomas Pringle on this project, as Irene said, through the Sustainability Projects Fund at McGill, as well as it's also funded by the Digital Arts Engine, which is, a fund organized by Digital Humanities at McGill. Right now, although you can't see this at home or in your automobiles, we have enlisted the help of Bronwyn, an audience member here, to power our bike-powered generators on Thomas's bicycle as we look to project a film from 1902 called The Life, A Day in the Life of an American Firefighter. So, yes, that is happening. Thomas is going to come up and talk a bit about the backstory to this project, what it is that inspired us to get started on it, before we'll talk a bit about our future projects, as Irene mentioned, and a bit about the theory and motivations behind it as well.
Hello. So we became really interested in this project. First off, we were thinking about just simply how to get moving images off the grid and trying to think about our environment in a little bit of a different way. I think the initial idea, there are practices like this that have occurred in countries that don't have pervasive power grids. Place to place and establish power and cinema and activism through those means. But we were concerned about taking this kind of mobility and putting it in places where you might not otherwise see movement. And I think that was fueled by a broad set of philosophical concerns, like how can we reanimate certain spaces that don't normally seem so vibrant. So in that sense, we were really thinking ecologically about cities and not just about natural settings. But I'll let Tyler say a little bit more about that.
Developing Thomas's point, one of the ways in which I justify this project to myself politically is through the ways in which it can at least potentially complicate some of the cultural dispositions that have given rise to the ecological crisis as I understand it, and for one that's a dualization of culture and civilization over and against a natural sort of wild realm that needs to be dominated and tamed, and a sort of what's called like an ontological relationship with non-human actants that through which we frame them as resources, objects to be appropriated for capitalist production almost exclusively. So by taking art and cinema out of almost exclusively cultural spheres, the academy, the theater, and trying to reinsert film into spaces otherwise thought of as natural, be it Parc Mont-Royal or Parc Jean-Mons or elsewhere, trying to just give rise to new ways of thinking about how it is that we relate to, non-human biological or ecological settings. And then as Thomas started to talk about as well, he briefly touched on the point around reanimating spaces that aren't typically thought of as vibrant. And I think there's a lot of potential in this project to, intervene into public spaces that are often navigated sort of teleologically, be they sidewalks, you know, the sides of roads, spaces that we don't often stop to spend much time, trying to make those, I guess, more meaningful to people for us moments of hesitation through interventions that force people to slow down and effectively smell the roses in ways that we aren't really able to do otherwise by virtue of, you know, the utilitarian schedules that we live according to a lot of the time in this sort of, yeah, this capitalist setting. So just to narrate what's going on, there's a silent film being projected right now. There are people on horseback, carriages. It's 1902, the dead of winter.
So we've got a reason why we chose this film to screen here this evening. And you know, one of our primary sort of objectives with this project is to think about how we image the world and how our imaging of the natural environment has changed over time. So in the sense that, you know, we've become accustomed to looking at nature a certain way, you can look at, you know, say archival film or older pieces of art as a document of how human beings, you know, at one point related to the environment. And so in a weird sense, by engaging with, you know, filmmaking from 1902 in a natural setting, you're also really thinking about how human beings saw the world at that point in time and how that's evolved in itself. So it's a kind of weird sensory recycling, you could almost call it. But, you know, it's so that's another aspect of how we consider this mobility and sustainability as something a little bit further than, you know, ameliorating climate concerns, which is something that we've also sort of addressed, is that, you know, if we're really trying to offset carbon emissions by, you know, I think it's got to be 40%, 60% within 40 years to stave off a 2% climate change, that requires a total overhaul of human energy systems and the way that we relate in general. And that's not a change that necessarily can easily come through policy, but also through practices in the humanities and artistic practices. So that's been another one of our interventions or something that we're thinking about. So I think Tyler's got something to say about a few of our future plans. Mm.
That's right. This month is April. In the month of May, we're looking to collaborate with, I guess, a couple of projects equally funded through the Sustainability Projects Fund at McGill, be it La Cave, which is the collectively, or rather it's the Bike Collective run out of the McGill Residence, Solon Hall in St. Henry. We're also looking to collaborate with Divest's McGill and Concordia, as well as Climate Justice Montreal around a screening. And we're also, yeah, very open to collaborating with anybody who's willing to sort of put this form to use, to foreground any and all critically thoughtful content that they're working on. And as Irene briefly touched on at the start of the presentation, we're looking to collaborate with Under the Weather and CKUT in the month of June. Ambitiously looking towards the possibility of an entirely bike-powered broadcast. It's going to happen. and we just got confirmation that McGill professor Alana Thane will be giving a talk in June, I guess, yeah, at that broadcast about media ecologies and the difference between how it is that we otherwise conceptualize the natural world in ways that are potentially quite problematic, or they are very problematic. And that's all I have to say about that. Questions? Anybody from the floor?
Nicole?
Does the bicycle have brakes on it?
Thomas, would you like to answer that?
currently, it is a braked bicycle, but that's because we haven't built a bicycle directly for this use. We're building a bike that is going to be for cargo, for carrying it. So we hope to eventually be using the same bike to carry everything as we power it. But at the moment, we're just using my bicycle, which is just a regular commuter cycle at the back. So, Any other questions, or are we... Yeah.
What kind of films do you project at your screenings?
We have a pretty extensive archive that we're working out of, or off of, through the Merle, a lot of which has been developed through, like, dumpstering film that's been thrown out. So right now we have, we're using a 16mm projector. We have, a lot of other films from which we draw. And then we're also investing in a digital projector, an environmentally efficient digital projector, with which we'll be able to project a lot more.
So, I mean, thematically, I'm not sure if we're... I mean, we are interested in projecting films with a more central environmental concern that more directly addresses contemporary or historical environmental concerns. But we're also very, very interested in conceiving of other kinds of media, perhaps things that are experimental, things about animals, things about the human being's relationship to the world, as a kind of expanded environmentalism. So, it doesn't have to be in the box, you know, so to say. We're trying to think a little bit outside of that, and hopefully, we can expand our thoughts as to what it means to think about the environment. I mean, that's overall, I think, the project, but I don't know. Any other questions? Or all right. Well, thank you so much for having us. Oh, and we have a website up. You can find out more as we develop it at mirl.lab.mcgill.ca. And there's a follow-through right there. Okay, so who's going to take over? Irene, thank you so much.
Apparently we have another question. The question is, how easy would it be to take this projection from a bike to developing communities? Tyler, can you comment on that?
I can. Because the question was asked over text, be difficult for me to ask a clarificatory question before I try to respond, but I'm not 100%. Yeah, I guess more broadly speaking, to communities that aren't, say, located in the downtown core of Montreal, it's going to be quite easy for us to do that, especially as we get a stronger bike, hopefully invest in an affordable cargo bike with which we'll be able to move everything around. And ideally, try and sort of deconstruct the sort of dynamic that McGill otherwise has to the Montreal community by taking art like this into communities and spaces that, that want to use them in ways that are more meaningful than cinema can be if it's really alienating and, restricted to the ivory tower. So, okay, and that's that. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
All right, and now I am really excited to introduce our speaker for the night, Joanna Petrasek-McDonald. I first heard of Joanna's work when I saw her speak at the panel on climate change and human rights a couple of months ago, and it was a panel hosted by Divest McGill and Animus D. McGill. And I was intrigued to hear more about her work upon learning that she is working on her master's thesis on climate change and its impacts on mental health in Inuit youth in Nanatsiavut. It was a take on climate change research that I had never heard before, and it absolutely fascinated me. Joanna's interest in youth and climate change stemmed from a background in climate activism, including having attended both COP15 and COP16 for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change as a Canadian youth delegate, as well as serving on the executive committee for the Sierra Youth Coalition. She has a bachelor's degree from the University of Guelph in Environmental Studies and is now working on completing her master's thesis in James Ford's Climate Change Adaptation Research Group in the Department of Geography here at McGill. Please welcome Joanna Petrasek-McDonald.
Great. Thanks very much. So I'm just going to have a seat here and settle in. I just wanted to thank Irene for inviting me and the Under the Weather crew. It's really cool to be broadcasting live and also be here talking to everyone here, which is great. So the title of my talk today is A Necessary Voice, Youth Engagement in Climate Change Research, Policy, and Action. And when I was trying to decide what I wanted to talk about and spend time talking on, I was thinking about the different things. Irene and I had a conversation about climate change and mental health stuff, the activism stuff, the work that I've done with youth, and I was kind of sending emails to a friend, and she said, "Well, just speak about what you're passionate about," and that just seemed kind of like a no-brainer. And what I'm really passionate about is the youth voice in climate change issues. And so, alluding to my title, I think that the youth voice is a necessary voice, and it's an important voice in climate change policy and climate change research and in climate change action all over the world. So I'm going to talk today about using my own voice as a youth in climate change, in the climate change movement, and then work that I've done and pursued to advocate for the importance of the youth voice. And so I want to just tell you my story. I think it's this is a really nice opportunity to share stories. And mine kind of, I'm going to boil it down into three parts just to make it simple. So I'm going to talk about my involvement in the United Nations climate change conferences. And then I'm going to talk about work that I did in my undergrad, kind of following my experiences at those conferences. And then I'm going to talk about my master's research. And so at the end, I hope you'll understand how I got to be studying climate change and mental health with youth. And I think you'll understand why I'm doing it as well. So I think it's important to set the stage and tell stories because everyone in the Climate Change Adaptation Research Lab and in the Geography Department has a really interesting story. And that, you know, our stories illustrate why we're doing what we're doing. So mine begins, I'm going to begin as an undergrad when I was at the University of Guelph doing my undergrad in environmental sciences. So I have a science background, but now I'm studying human geography. So it's never difficult to switch if you know you're in science and want to go to arts. It's, very doable. I was always super involved on campus, and I really loved the energy of student initiatives on campus. And Guelph was a great university for that. There were so many different student groups and student initiatives that happened. And so I was involved in quite a few. A lot were based on environmental issues. And some of the things I did was a part of a Guelph Students for Environmental Change, and we did Wasteless Wednesdays. There was a subgroup called Tap In that I spent a lot of time with, and we were trying to get bottled water off campus. I was part of the student group that organized the Sustainability Week one year. And so in all of these initiatives, the people that I worked with just gave me so much energy because we were all working together and using, you know, what we had and the resources we had to create a sustainability week with different workshops and activities available for students. Or we were working to try and make our campus a better place. And so that's kind of an important part of my background because I've kind of become addicted to student activity and student action. And so I was also in the co-op program. So every other semester I would be on a work term. And the first work term I did was with the Canadian Standards Association. And so I was working on greenhouse gas inventory standards. And one of my colleagues had just come back from the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Poznan in Poland. And he was telling me about it, and I was really intrigued. And, you know, he was saying his experience there. And at that time, I was based in Ottawa, and I had been also attending a bunch of talks about the outcome of this, of Poznan and the lead up to Copenhagen, which was the next year. And so attending these talks and talking to my colleague, I really saw that there was a lot of activism and energy from civil society around the international climate change negotiations. Whereas I had always assumed that, you know, it was international climate negotiations were kind of just for the governments that were involved. But I found out, through talking to people and listening to talks that Actually, no. Civil society had a huge role in these climate change conferences. So, so I talked to people and kind of said, you know, I'm really interested in getting involved in this somehow. There must be a way for me to get involved and to contribute my voice in this way. And so, I found out about the Canadian Youth Delegation, and that's a delegation under the Canadian Youth Climate Coalition that takes. In Copenhagen and Cancun, which was the following year, it takes 30 youth from across Canada to the conferences. And so I found out about the CYD, as you'll come to realize, if you don't already, in climate change, there's so many acronyms. And if something's not an acronym, we make it into one. And so the CYD was the Canadian Youth Delegation. So I applied and got in. And so, you know, a few months later, found myself headed to Copenhagen with 29 other youth. And so I'm not going to lie, that was the 2 weeks that I spent in Copenhagen was a bit of a blur, because these conferences are massive, and everyone had said, you know, really the first one you go to, you just go to get used to it and to kind of figure out your groove and, you know, how you want to work with it. Because what you typically think of is, you know, a big conference center where there's negotiators giving speeches about what their country's willing to commit to and talking about climate change mitigation and adaptation. And so that's one part of it. You know, there's these big negotiations going on. There's sub-negotiations. So there's, you know, smaller groups talking about different aspects of a bigger negotiation. And I should take a moment to say the goal of these climate change conferences is to talk about international cooperation towards dealing with anthropogenic caused climate change. And so in Copenhagen, the idea was to get to an agreement that would follow the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol ended in 2012. And in Copenhagen, the hope was, there was so much build up to it, because the hope was that countries would sign a new accord that would follow the Kyoto Protocol. So there's all these meetings going on about the different aspects of what a new protocol would look like. And that's kind of the negotiation side of it. But in addition to that, there's hundreds of side events. And side events are when NGOs or companies have workshops or presentations on different issues. It could be, you know, a presentation on climate change in the Arctic or climate justice, or it could be a presentation about a new technology or new renewable technology. So there's all these side events going on. And then at the same time, there's this huge hall with hundreds of booths where universities and NGOs and, you know, renewable technology companies have these booths, and it's more of an information booth, so you kind of wander around and network. And so because climate change is such a complex and multifaceted issue, there's so many different angles you can come at it. And I was, as you know, a young, eager, new to the climate movement activist, I was just taken aback by how many different angles I could come at it. And so it took me kind of the 2 weeks to really figure out, you know, my groove and everything. But the interesting thing is that the youth, there were thousands of youth in Copenhagen, and the youth, I think, bring the color to these conferences, because a lot of what youth do is, in addition to attending these meetings, you know, the Canadian Youth Delegation, we would attend a lot of the meetings where Canada would be there, so we could keep track of what Canada was saying and report back. We had daily newsletters that went out and podcasts that went out. And so we would kind of follow the meetings and gather information. But a big part of what the youth do at these conferences is actions. And actions are kind of like demonstrations or, I guess, exhibits within the conference center. And so a lot of the Canadian Youth Delegation's actions were based around Canada. We had actions trying to bring light and attention to the tar sands, which is something that, of course, the Canadian negotiating team wouldn't talk about at the conference. You know, they don't want to talk about the tar sands at all, but it's a huge, I think it's one of the biggest emitter in Canada, and it's one of the main reasons that the Canadian, you know, our targets are so low, is because that would, what would that do to the tar sands? And so we spent a lot of, we focused a lot on that. And then we also joined with international youth and had different actions. So, for example, there were actions on encouraging science-based targets. Near the end of the conference, there was actions on, you know, saying, because it was looking like a deal wasn't going to be reached, there was actions with you know, all the youth from around the world that were there, which again was hundreds of youth. There was actions to kind of say, to shame negotiators and say, listen, you know, this isn't just, you know, a walk in the park. We're talking about the future. And so, you know, that was brought to light. And then there was also actions from youth who were there from developing countries about climate justice and talking about the climate debt that rich countries owe. And there were just it was incredible to see every day, you know, tens of like just many, many different actions that were going on within the conference center. And like I said, that really colors it because you're not losing the, you know, the purpose of why we're there, which I think can get lost if you're just sitting in a negotiation room talking about the text of an agreement. But if you remind yourself, why are we here? Why are we talking about this? I think that really is an important part of it. And so the youth, I realized at this conference, were an incredible and a very important part of the process. There was something called Young and Future Generations Day, where all the youth in the conference center wore orange T-shirts. And that was to kind of bring to light the fact that, you know, we were part of this process. There's so many young people who are going to be dealing with the decisions that were made at that meeting. And, you know, in our future, those decisions are going to impact our future. And it was really inspiring to see how many orange shirts were floating around the conference center on that day. And then near the end of the conference, one of the bigger actions we did was a sit-in. And that was because, you know, again, we realized that there was a deal wasn't going to be reached. And so we joined with youth from around the world and sat in the conference center, refusing to leave, holding signs that said fair, ambitious, and legally binding, because those were the three criteria that we felt were important to a deal, and we felt that were not being met. And there was a petition of 11 million people that also were calling for a fair, ambitious, and legally binding deal. And so just, you know, just talking about it gives me goosebumps, because it was incredible to be around so many people who were, you know, all had energy and passion for the same outcome, but yet to be in a situation where that outcome wasn't looking like it was going to happen. And so we said, you know, we weren't going to leave the conference center until negotiators came to a fair, ambitious, and legally binding deal. But in the end, we were approached and told that if we didn't leave the conference center the next day, which was the last day of the negotiations, none of the civil society representatives would be able to get into the conference center, and that meant people like the director of Greenpeace would be barred from coming in. And so we didn't want to be the reason that no civil society would get in. We still wanted some civil society to get in, and so we ended up having to leave around 3 a.m. But so, you know, actions like that, and then also I was part of the biggest protest I've ever been a part of. There were 100,000 people that came together in Copenhagen to march for climate justice on the International Day of Action, which was the weekend in between the 2 weeks that the conference was happening. And so that was just an incredible feeling, because it was a very positive march. Everyone was coming together, you know, and calling for, again, action and ambitious action and fair action on climate change. And so it was really interesting to see people from around the world, people of all different ages, babies, elderly people, all marching together. And so that was, again, something that really inspired me. Being part of that was an incredible experience. Then there was also a day where a few days later, there was a walk called Reclaim Power. And again, it was attended by thousands of people. And that was more calling for system change, not climate change, was kind of the motto behind that. And that was bringing to light the fact that there were flaws within the UN system where, you know, for example, developing countries who don't have capacity to have, you know, as many members as a developed country would have at the negotiations, you know, that brings injustice into the system. And so there was issues, that issue was dealt with on the Reclaim Power Walk. So anyways, that kind of brings me basically, I think the outcome of that, there were a lot of people that burnt out after Copenhagen. I saw some of, you know, the most inspiring climate activists that I worked with, you know, kind of have a burnout after, you know, this 2 weeks of where so much energy, so much build up to it had happened. There was so much energy put into it. And then there was kind of like the outcome was just really depressing because no agreement was reached. So a lot of people burnt out after that, but I think I was an exception because I was so motivated after I got back, and I was just so inspired by the commitment of youth from all across the world. And so I wanted to kind of keep going and keep doing things, and I had a lot of energy out of it. And so I did things like I gave talks at my old elementary school and high school, I joined the Sierra Youth Coalition, the executive committee. It's a coalition of environmental youth organizations. So I was trying to do things more locally because definitely the international scene is very overwhelming. And I think there's people who have worked in it for years and continue to work in it. And I think it's important to experience. And I went to Cancun the next year. That was the next conference after Copenhagen, and participated in the Canadian Youth Delegation again and did more work. And that time I kind of had more of a groove and knew I was more interested in the adaptation stream of things, in which I focused on. But I think that, yeah, it's important to find where you are most inspired by. And because I was inspired by the youth in particular and not more so, a certain angle to climate change, I realized that maybe my energy should be put into advocating for the youth voice in climate change research and policy and action. And so I returned to Guelph after Copenhagen, and I had the chance to do an independent study with a TA of mine who I'd had in first year. And so she was working on a project with another PhD student at the University of Guelph called Changing Climate, Changing Health, Changing Stories. And that was a project looking at health and climate change, health being all aspects of health, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And they were looking at health and climate change in a northern community called Rigolet, which is in northern Labrador. And so they brought me onto the project and said, you can kind of, do whatever you want as a mini research project. And so being on this high of youth involvement in climate change, I was like, well, I definitely want to focus on youth. And so in that sense, I realized that there's many different ways to be an activist. At the UN climate change conferences, I guess you could say I was more of a traditional activist, you know, going to protests. But I feel like, you know, I think activism is about advocating for what you believe in. And I feel that through my work in universities, I've been able to still do that. And so I would still say that that is activism. And so I guess moving into this more focused project, kind of going from international more to now local, I looked at youth observations and perceptions of climate change in the North. And so up on the screen here, for those of you who are here, you'll see there's the four Inuit settlement regions in Canada. There's Inuvialuit, Nunavut, Nunatsiavut, and Nunavik. Nunatsiavut is the easternmost settlement region. It's the northern coast of Labrador. And there's five communities within Nunatsiavut. Rigolet is the southernmost community, and that's where this project that I mentioned was taking place. So Rigolet, I'll just give you a bit of background into it before I talk about the work that that we did. But Rigolet is a community of approximately 300 people. It's super small. It's a fly-in only community. You can get there by skidoo in the winter. In the summer, you have to go by ferry or by plane. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. The Labrador flag is blue, green, and white. And when I go there, I can see why, because you have, you know, the incredible crisp blue sky, you have the deep green of the trees, and then the pure white of the snow. And so it's kind of surrounding you while you're there. It's a beautiful community. And in my undergrad, the research that was done, I didn't actually go up to Rigolet. It was only my master's when I continued work in Rigolet that I went up. But every time I go up, I'm just, I feel so thankful to have gone up there and to work with the people up there. They're really wonderful and friendly and just an incredible people to meet and to have developed friendships with. So I do want to acknowledge that as I'm talking about this work, you know, it's coming from the community of Rigolet, and the Changing Climate, Changing Health, Changing Stories project was a community-led project. And the project that I'm currently working on, the Inuit Mental Health Adaptation to Climate Change, is also a community-led project. So the community is really leading the research up there, and so I'm just here kind of, I guess, on behalf of the community, explaining what we found from this research. But it's too bad they couldn't be here telling you about it themselves. But c'est la vie. So from the youth research that I did with the Changing Stories Project, we found that youth were observing changes in the climate and the environment. So it's happening. Climate change is happening and impacting the North very quickly. Youth we talked to are between the ages of 12 and 25, and so within the lifetime of youth, they are able to observe changes in the snow, changes in ice, the ice stability and extent has changed, changes in animal patterns and in plant patterns. And so these changes also have impacts on the way of life of people there. For example, in the wintertime, going out to the cabin on Skidoo is one of the best things you can do. It's just people love it. And so going out on the ice, though, requires stable ice, and it requires snow to be able to make it to your cabin, which might be an hour away on Skidoo. And so, you know, that means that changes in ice are impacting being able to get out on the land and get out to the cabin or get out to go hunting. There's a clear connection between the changes that youth are observing and impacts on their lives. Interestingly, youth also had concern for elders that came out in the interview. So the method that was done for this research was digital storytelling. People were invited to create digital stories, and there's a digital storytelling lab that's based in Rigolet. It's a really unique lab that houses equipment and support and resources for digital media projects. And so the digital stories that came out of that were followed up by interviews as well. And so it's through the interviews that these findings came out. But so interestingly, youth had concern for elders, and a lot of the research that I had looked at prior to doing this research was talking about how elders are concerned about youth not being able to learn traditional skills or gain traditional knowledge because of the inability to get out on the land. But interestingly, youth were concerned about elders, saying that, you know, it must be totally different for them with this change in the land, because they grew up with something, you know, totally different. And so that was a really interesting finding that came out. Also, the impact on cultural identity, like I talked about, going out to the cabin, going hunting, so many activities that are part of traditional life and Inuit culture depend on the land. And so not being able to do that has an impact on your culture. There were a lot of emotional impacts too, all negative. So a lot of people voiced anger, frustration, being very sad about not being able to get out, being very worried and uncertain about what the future would hold. And so that kind of is getting into the more mental health aspect of it. And then envisioning adaptation in the future was something that interestingly came out. So youth talked about thinking how, if things change and continue to change as they're going now, you know, how are we going to have to change? We might have to build roads, for example, or go out and boat earlier. So youth are thinking about how to adapt in the future. And so based on that research, then we found, you know, there were observations in climate change of climate and environmental changes, which had impact on traditional activities like going to the cabin, getting out on the land, going hunting, and that had impacts on Inuit culture and well-being. So that project has now wrapped up, but it has kind of been the base and the springboard for other research that has been going on in the region of Nanatsiavut. I mentioned the Inuit Mental Health Adaptation to Climate Change Project, which is a project going on throughout all five communities in Nanatsiavut. And that project is looking at, more specifically, is focused on impacts of climate change on mental health throughout the region. And it's being led by all five communities. And the principal investigator is Dr. Ashley Consola-Willox at the University of Cape Breton. And so if you're interested in more about the climate change and mental health work, I'd really encourage you to check it out. And they'll be, we'll be able to, if you go to the, I guess, the CKUT website, we'll have the websites for that work. But, so my work is based under my current master's work is based under the mental health project that's going on. And the title of the master's work is From the Minds of Youth. So again, you can see there's that youth focus, and that has been the common thread throughout all of the work that I've done since having come back from the UN climate change conferences. So From the Minds of Youth is a project looking at the youth aspect of climate change and mental health. It's involved also this master's research falls under the Inuit Traditional Knowledge for Adapting to the Health Effects of Climate Change project called IKADAPT. The research is looking at, not only is it looking at climate change and mental health and how, you know, what the connections between the two with youth, Inuit youth in Inatsiavut, but I was also looking at using digital media, specifically participatory video, with these youth and how that might connect to resilience. So my thesis and my master's research is kind of broken down into three parts. The first part is a literature review that's been done on looking at what are the protective factors that enhance mental health and well-being for Indigenous youth in the circumpolar world. And so there's several different protective factors that are mentioned in literature. For example, staying busy, having meaningful relationships with people in the community, feeling support from the community, feeling cultural pride, all these things protect against mental health challenges. Then the second part of the research was doing the participatory video, and that was piloted in Rigolet. A participatory video is a method in which you bring together research participants and you give them the equipment, the support, and the tools to create a video. So it can be about whatever they want it to be. It comes from their voices, it comes from their perspectives, and it's very much controlled by participants. The design, the planning, the filming, the editing, the production is all participant-led. So we had seven students that worked with us in Rigolet on this participatory video. We also had Jordan and Curtis Konek, who are two Inuit youth filmmakers from Arviat, Nunavut, and they were great. They came to provide the training in filming and editing, and also to provide their editing skills. Then we worked with the Northern Lights Academy School. That's the school in Rigolet. There's 50 students at the school. And we also worked with the MyWord Digital Media and Storytelling Lab that I mentioned earlier. And so they provided all the equipment for us to use. And it wouldn't have been possible without that digital media lab already being in Rigolet. So we had a great group of people. And the way that we set up the participatory video workshop was to have 1 week of filming. And so the youth decided they wanted to make a film about their lives in Rigolet and what they do in the winter, and share that with people. And so we had 2 hours a day, every day after school for 2 weeks. That was it. And they decided to, you know, in order to create a video about their lives, they wanted to do things like do filming on the skidoo, because that's how people get around in the winter. They wanted to film going out on a boil-up, which is going out for a campfire out on the land in the winter. They wanted to film sliding, which is tobogganing down hills. They wanted to film activities at the youth center, activities in the gym, all the kind of things that they do. And so we spent a week doing that. It was lots of fun. Then the second week, we spent editing. And so we used iMovie, and all the students had the chance to create their own clips in iMovie and receive training. Although some youth already had great skills in iMovie and moved on to using Final Cut Pro X software because they already, you know, already had the skills. In the end, only a few of the youth were interested in developing clips, so they developed their clips, and then we had Jordan Konek put the rest of the film together using the different footage that they had collected. We screened what he had put together, including the clips from the students, and showed it to the students, and they would give us their feedback and say, yes, this is great, or, we kind of want that changed, or, you know, this is missing. And so we went through those steps several times until we kind of came to a final film that was liked by all the students and that they felt was what they wanted. And then in the Saturday after the second week, we had a community screening. And so we invited the community to come and watch the film the youth had made. And that was a great time because we had a full house, and oftentimes it's hard to get people to come out to these kinds of events, and we had so many people come out. So the students, I think, felt very supported and very proud of the video they had made. And so that was the participatory video project. And then the third part of my thesis is looking at interviews that were done with youth across Nanatsivit on climate change and mental health and talking about those connections. And so I'm currently in the stages of writing my thesis, and so I can't comment on kind of the final results that are coming out, but I can say that in the participatory video is the interviews I did with participants and community members and parents and teachers after I stayed for an extra week and did interviews with these people. And what came out of that is that the process of creating a participatory video and screening it for the community was connected to protective factors that had been identified in that the lit review that I did. So, for example, pride. There was great pride in having, you know, created this film and, you know, seeing the product of their own work. There was also community pride that was expressed in the film. I'm going to show you a clip in a little bit, and you'll see that the youth are so proud to be from Rigolet, and they were very intentionally trying to disprove the negative stereotype of northern remote communities being boring or isolating. So there was a lot of community pride that came out of it. Also, there was a lot of control and ownership that was felt over the process, which was really important for developing confidence and self-esteem. And a lot of the adults commented on using video as a form of participation for youth. So, you know, participating in community issues that normally maybe they wouldn't be normally involved in. So that work is still evolving, and I'll say stay tuned. If you just check out jamesford.ca, the work will be posted when it's all done, which fingers crossed will be this summer. So before I show the final film, I also just want to talk about Northern research, because this was something I've had the chance to go to Rigolet now 4 times and work with the students there. Doing Northern research is an experience in and of itself, and participating in the community is a really important part of it. Getting to know the community is, I think, the basis of any good research. And so when I've been up there, I've had a lot of first experiences. I had learned how to shoot for the first time. I went to my first dog team race, which was part of the annual winter festival. This year I just missed it by a week, which was too bad. But that was one of the funnest days I think I had up there. And one of the first days I was up, I shot a gun and also watched a dog team race all in one day. It was pretty exhausting. And then I also learned how to drive skidoo, which is, like I said, that's how people get around in the winter. And so I think I actually love being on skidoo. And initially hearing about people talk about going out on the land and how, you know, they just love it and the feelings they get out when they're out, I think I understand it more now having experienced it myself. I've also participated and gone on many boil-ups myself, which is great. And then bingo is a huge thing as well. Every Tuesday and Thursday we play bingo, and I have yet to have a bingo, but we'll see, maybe next time. And then going out to the cabin, like I talked about, that's a big part of life. And so I had the fortune of being brought out twice. It's just an incredible experience to be able to share in those special activities. And then the last, when I was up in May, I usually only go up, I've only been up in the winter, but I was up at the beginning of May and got to go out on boat and trawl for scallops and try raw scallops, which was also incredible. So it's really interesting to see how the different activities, depending on the time of year, there's just so much to do. So I'm going to show the final film, or the film now. For those of you tuning in, you can check it out on YouTube. If you just type in Life in Rigolet, you'll be able to find it. It's a 17-minute film, and then there's also a behind-the-scenes feature that I would encourage you to check out. And so I'm just going to end with this quote from one of the teachers, because I think it illuminates the fact that research, being able to leave something behind for participants, is so important. And so one of the teachers said, "They won't forget it. They've made a memory now and will have it. They'll always have that video. It's something they will enjoy to watch." And for me, I think that's the most meaningful thing out of my master's, is that I was able to do something that was meaningful for youth. Not only is it bringing the youth voice out in climate change research and drawing importance to that, but it's also leaving something for the youth participants that I worked with. And so, so that's been just in very rewarding. I think also the kind of final messages that I would say have come out of both of these research projects, the undergrad one and now my master's one, are the importance of the youth voice in research, and the fact that research only gets richer when you're incorporating the youth voice, and adaptation policies only become stronger when you're incorporating youth voices, because they're the ones who are going to be seeing these adaptation policies through to the future. And so hopefully you've been able to kind of see how I've taken that passion for youth engagement in climate change research and brought it into academia. And I hope this is an example of how, you know, whatever you're passionate in, you can always bring that to academia. It's not to say that if you're passionate in activism, bring it to academia. One doesn't negate the other. So with that, I'll say thank you. And I'd also just like to thank everyone who's made this research possible. There's been so many individuals and organizations to name, I just kind of want to do a general shout out to everyone who's contributed to this research, in both support and resources, and late night phone calls. So thank you. And I guess now we can show the video. And again, for those of you tuning in at home or in your cars, just YouTube Life in Rigolet, and you'll be able to see what's going on with the audio that you'll hear now.
Boil ups, probably go to the cabin
for the day.
You go off somewhere and you have a fire and eat like on a boil up. We just go off somewhere and make a fire and have food. Sometimes me and Char will just go on boil ups for ourselves.
In winter and spring, usually, we go ice fishing, go on boil ups, going riding. That's good news.
Wrigley is